Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Today on the show, we have Terry Branham Clark, who's running for State House of Representatives in the 100th District in northeastern Kentucky in Ashland. You know, I have deep roots there, Jasmine.
You do.
I talked about this in the interview with Ms. Clark, but she used to work with my grandmother-in-law, and her primary opponent sold me a couch. So that's,
look at that.
I know. There you go. So it was a good interview, and she was very informed and had a lot of good stuff to say. So we're looking forward to sharing that with you guys. But before we get to that, we have some other issues to talk to you about. We have a Marcy's Law court case. We have some information about Bevin's tweets, some new Bevin's tweets that are making news. We also have some other information about Christian Motley's appeal, a KREF opinion about Josie Raymond, and maybe even some more stuff. So without any further ado, Jasmine, tell us about Marcy's Law.
All right, so round one of the Marcy's Law battle goes to the KACDL.
That's the Kentucky Association for Criminal Defense Lawyers.
Exactly.
I've told
people that a lot. They should know by now.
I remember that. I wasn't even looking at the notes, I promise.
Okay. So, Franklin Circuit Court Judge Thomas Wingate held that the language for the Marcy's Law ballot question is too vague. This was not a trial, though. Okay. This is what was called a motion for summary judgment. A motion for summary judgment is what you file when you believe that there aren't important facts about the case in dispute. So basically, a motion for summary judgment would go like this. These are the facts of the case. Here's the law. Here's what the defense might argue. But even if they're correct, we still win.
Right. So it's basically
the facts
like
and the law are on our
a
side.
Proof. It's a mathematical proof, but with the law.
Sure.
Okay.
The defense is arguing the plaintiff is wrong about how the law applies, or that they're wrong in saying that the facts aren't in dispute. So in this case, the defense filed a cross motion for summary judgment, and that motion was denied, and the plaintiff's, the KACDL's motion was granted. The relief being that the Secretary of State is enjoined from certifying the votes for or against Senate Bill 3, which is Marcy's Law. So they can be counted, but they cannot be used to amend the Constitution until appeals have been exhausted.
Okay, so we're actually going to vote on it, but that they may not necessarily mean anything.
They can't certify
right.
the votes to create the constitutional amendment. So it's still going to be on the ballot at this point.
One other thing, this is about Marcy's Law, and people who listen to the show, they know what that is, but just remind us real quick, what is Marcy's Law?
Oh, come on. Marcy's Law is a constitutional amendment that would create constitutional rights for victims. We already have a Crime Victims Bill of Rights in the Kentucky Revised Statute. This makes those rights a constitutional amendment, and it also may give victims standing, like they can hire their own attorney and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do I need...
No, that's good.
Okay. Because if I need to tell you all the reasons that it's bad, we would be here all night,
right,
Robert.
We did a whole show on it, so you can definitely go back and listen to that. But yeah, just in case people were wondering.
Okay. So here's the question that would be on the ballot one more time. We've talked about this before, too, but I think it's important to understand why the judge ruled the way he did. So the question would say, are you in favor of providing constitutional rights to victims of crime, including the right to be treated fairly, with dignity and respect, and the right to be informed and to have a voice in the judicial process?
Who on earth is going
right.
to vote
everyone's
no to that?
In yeah. favor of that. And we already have laws that
even you, Jasmine, even
protect all
of
those
of
things. Yeah, sure. So Judge Wingate said that the question was misleading and it failed to inform the public of the actual substance, mm-hmm. which I think is correct.
That's fair. Right. Right.
Whitney Westerfield, the bill's sponsor, he expressed his disappointment, and the notice of appeal has actually already been filed. They filed that yesterday. It should be noted that the KACDL is really the only group standing up against Marcy's Law. Marcy's Law Incorporated has a ton of money.
Right.
They are a pretty powerful group who has gotten this law passed in a lot of places, and they advertise the heck out of it. The KACDL has a tiny shoestring budget. Marcy's Law Incorporated has probably spent more on advertising in the last 3 days than KACDL
right.
has all year,
right.
probably. So if you're a criminal defense attorney out there listening to us, you should join the KACDL. I mean, they're the ones really standing up and fighting against this. And a lot of prosecutors, most that I know at least, disagree with this, but they can't really stand up and voice those concerns.
And they can't join the KACDL as prosecutors, probably.
That's true, also.
Yeah, yeah. And one thing I did think that was nice about this, you know, obviously Senator Westerfield was disappointed, but he didn't, like, make a video and say all criminal defense attorneys and judges are the worst.
Right. Yeah. I saw people commending, I saw Mark Murphy, the cartoonist, commending him on Twitter for how he handled it. And, you know, he made a respectful statement about it.
Yeah.
He didn't.
It's probably like literally
slam the judge.
Yeah, it's probably
personally.
Like literally the least that he could do. But you know, we need to commit.
But we
people.
Appreciate
yeah,
that now.
It's
right?
unusual at this point. Yeah. So that's Marcy's.
It's such a huge win to start with. You know,
right.
I don't know what's going to happen on appeal, but Dave Niehaus, the attorney for the KACDL, he's an awesome attorney, and I'm really happy right now.
Right. Good. I'm glad that you're happy, Jasmine. I'm happy too. Okay, Jasmine, Matt Bevin has a Twitter account. You may know that. And like other Republican executives in this country, Governor Bevin has had some trouble with his Twitter. You know, he's the subject of several lawsuits regarding the legality of public officials to block their constituents on social media. And now some of his actual tweets may have caused an issue with the Ethics Commission. So there's two tweets that kind of this story is about. There was a Trump rally in Richmond, which we'll talk more about later. But after that rally, or maybe during that rally, Governor Bevin tweeted from his @GovMattBevin account. And that tweet, the Amy McGrath campaign thought, or probably interpreted that tweet as expressing support for Andy Barr, which would not be allowed. So here's the actual tweet. Quote, here at EKU with a packed house of men, women, and children who love our POTUS, real Donald Trump, and are supporting Rep. Andy Barr on November 8th. We are KY. So, Jasmine, you're not allowed to electioneer using state resources. And the Kentucky Democratic Party filed an ethics complaint on Tuesday about that tweet. That tweet has now been deleted. The ethics complaint did not impress Governor Bevin. Here's a quote that he gave. The Pavlovian response by the lapdogs to a photograph of a rally attended by many supporters of Congressman Andy Barr is an example of everything wrong with the modern world of politics. I put the picture up on Twitter because it actually happened here in Kentucky, and I assume some people who were not there might want to see it. Apparently, however, the fact that people support and appreciate President Trump and Congressman Barr is too much for hypersensitive liberal minds to handle. I do appreciate his juxtaposition of Pavlovian with lapdogs. That's a that's some nice writing. That's a some parallelism that I can appreciate, even though I think the statement's a little silly. In addition, Jasmine. First of all, this tweet about the Trump rally, maybe I could see how it could be interpreted.
Right. When I first read it, I read he was there supporting Andy Barr, but then when I heard you read it, I was like, okay, I guess he's saying the men, women, and children are supporting
you
him.
Put yourself in a defense attorney mode. And yeah, no, I get it. I can kind of see how he might find a way to wiggle out of this one. But there's no, I mean, at the same time, there's no doubt that Governor Bevin supports Andy Barr, but he, and I don't know how much state resources were expended and that tweet picture, but I mean, I get it. We're gonna leave that to the Ethics Commission to figure out. But there's another tweet, Jasmine. This is probably one that got a little bit more attention last week. I think Governor Bevin last week tweeted a photo of him throwing and shooting grenades at the Kentucky State Penitentiary in Eddyville. Have you seen this video?
I saw so many people sharing it, like not in a positive way.
Right. Matt Jones got a hold of it and it was pretty funny.
I just didn't even want to look at it.
Yeah, it's great.
I saw the still shot and I was like, that's enough for me.
Yeah, I really encourage you to go look at it. The video showed, he threw these grenades and they exploded. And then, you know, the frame froze after the explosion and they superimposed these, like, do you remember the old 60s Batman? Did you ever, like, watch reruns of that as a kid or anything?
I didn't, but I know I know what you're talking about.
Right. And like, whenever like Batman would get in a fight, he would like punch the bad guy and it would freeze frame and they would be like pow and bang and they'd put it on the screen. And basically that's what happened. Governor Bevan threw these grenades in the air. They exploded and there was like things that they were blowing up. And the things that they were blowing up were things like corruption, pay to play, and red tape. You know, Jasmine, the veracity of the idea of Governor Bevan cleaning up corruption and pay for play, you know, especially since he probably like
all those big raises, and
big
everything.
Raises, you know, his house, that sounds like pay to play to me. But you know, this video itself has struck many people as problematic. And that's because Governor Bevan has said that he's running for re-election, but you know, he has not yet filed to do so. And he doesn't have any way to like spend money on a campaign yet. This video came from his state-funded account, and it appears, you know, to have been funded with state money. And unlike taking a picture of a crowd at a Donald Trump rally, these are grenades. They have a cost associated with them. That is something that has, you know, that they do cost some money. And the thing is, it looks and feels a lot like a campaign video, and you can't use state money to campaign. So this one, I think, may be even more problematic than the first.
Than the tweet.
Yeah, but Jasmine, the video itself, like I just said, it's absolutely bonkers. You really need to see it because it's literally the dumbest thing I've ever seen. You have never seen anything as ridiculous as a man in khakis and a blue blazer, you know, cocking a grenade launcher and shooting it. It's like, you know, it's like it. A man going through a midlife crisis and going to the Knob Creek gun range is what it looks like and feels like. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Except he did it at the prison.
I know. The way he like pulls, looks, he like grabs the grenade launcher, looks at the camera and like pulls the trigger. It's like insane. I really recommend you watch it. All right, Jasmine, tell us a little bit about Christian Motley.
All right. A couple weeks ago, we talked about a Lexington city council race. So the Fayette Circuit Court held that Christian Motley, a candidate for the council, did not have the required number of signatures on his petition to run for office and that his name would be struck from the ballot. So basically the issue was illegible signatures, family members signing for other people mm-hmm. that they didn't have consent to sign for and things like that. And Judge Scorsone held that he didn't have the 100 that he needed. Christian Motley appealed, and we got a quick ruling from the Court of Appeals last week, and it wasn't good for Mr. Motley. The 3-judge panel upheld the circuit court ruling for the same reasons. Mm-hmm. Motley can still try to run a write-in campaign, and he filed to do that yesterday on Tuesday. But it's going to be kind of confusing.
Right.
The Herald Leader article said, it will likely cause some confusion for voters, and that is true. His name will appear on the ballot because the ballots were printed weeks ago. But votes for him under his name will not be counted. Your vote will not be counted if you vote for him on the ballot. You have to write his name in under the write-in portion of the ballot.
Yeah, that's a difficult thing. The one successful write-in campaign that I've ever heard of at a high level or even for like a low level is somebody who's been in the news, Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who won a write-in campaign with the name Murkowski.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that it can be done. That would be very interesting because I think, you know, even if people don't vote for him by writing his name in, even if they just like bubble his name in on the ballot, those votes don't count for Fred Brown. So it isn't.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe that makes it a little bit more likely. But yeah, that's tough.
So if you live in Lexington and you support Christian Motley, tell everyone you know that you have to write his name in if they don't listen to this podcast.
Right. Yes. Please do that because he's great. Josie Raymond, friend of the show and Democratic nominee for District 31. She sent a request for guidance. I was looking for that in the opening. A request for guidance. That's what I was looking for. She sent one of those to the Kentucky Registry of Election Finance, KREF. And in the request for guidance, she asked if it was permissible for campaign funds to be used for child care. According to research by Insider Louisville, similar opinions have been issued that allow money to be used this way in Texas, Alabama, and Arkansas, and by the FEC, so federal elections. If you run for office on a federal level, you can use money for child care. However, Iowa and Connecticut have disallowed this use of funds. So after the opinion was issued in her favor, Ms. Raymond tweeted out, "This is a huge victory for parents in Kentucky who know that the advice, just take them with you, doesn't work when the kid has to pee after knocking on 12 doors or a tired baby starts screaming when a fundraiser runs past bedtime," unquote. So you know, a lot, Jasmine, has been made about how great this is for women candidates. And it definitely is. This is something that will help women run for office if they're able to spend money in this way. But in 2018, unless you're independently wealthy, both parents usually have to work. And this opinion allows for candidates of all genders to create a more equitable system that allows parents of children to run for office. Because, you know, just shove the kid with your spouse doesn't work if you're a woman or a man. Usually we should share the responsibilities of
raising
children. Right,
and I think this is really great that Josie Raymond did this. She is not even in the legislature yet, and she's already
making changes,
doing cool things for our state.
Absolutely.
And I think it also will hopefully encourage younger people to run that might have younger children.
That's
and
really
so
key.
This is great all around.
Absolutely. Okay, lastly, there were two rallies that happened in Kentucky last week. One featured President Donald Trump, and the other featured Vice President Joe Biden, or former Vice President Joe Biden. So Vice President Biden visited Bath County on Friday. He stumped there for Amy McGrath in the furthest eastern part of the 6th District, so like far outside of Lexington. So from reports, we weren't there, but from reports, it seemed like Biden appealed to civility and taking America back. And Amy McGrath spoke about her focus on positivity during the campaign. So that's nice. President Trump, he came to Richmond in Madison County on Saturday. And during his speech, Trump focused on Democrats' lust for power and his perhaps newfound affection for Kentucky senators who have both been, you know, thorns in his side at different points in time. He also called Andy Barr a great congressman. Do you think that Donald Trump like had ever heard of Andy Barr before they told him he was coming to Kentucky?
Probably not.
Yeah. Who knows?
Maybe.
Jasmine, this race is really tight and might be seen as like an early bellwether. So Kentucky's polls close first in the whole country, which is an absolute travesty.
Agreed.
We need to have our polls be open for at least 2 more hours, and our county clerks need to get it together. And therefore, this race will be one of the first really close races that reports results. It could really set the tone early on election night. If McGrath wins, it could portend like a big Democratic victory. And if Barr wins big, that could show that Democrats might be in trouble if they want to take back the House of Representatives. So that is why it's not too surprising to me that this race is getting national attention.
All right.
Well, that's it for us. Let's now listen to our interview with Terry Branham Clark.
Terry Branham Clark is the Democratic candidate for the 100th District in Boyd County in northeastern Kentucky. She's a business owner, and she's involved with several nonprofit organizations in the Ashland-Boyd County area. She's running to secede Kevin Sinnott, a Democrat who represented the 100th District since 2009. Ms. Clark faces Brian Clark in the general election after defeating her primary opponent, Ann Perkins, by 16 votes. Terry Branham Clark, welcome to My Old Kentucky Podcast.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me to chat.
All right. So while this is your first run for elected office, you do have a bit of political lineage. Did you always know that you would run for office someday? And why did you decide to jump into this year's election?
I never intended to run for political office. This was a complete surprise to not only myself, family, friends. I've always been politically interested, and I have come from a family who's been very involved in the Democrat Party in Boyd County and in the state. My dad was a member of the Boyd County Executive Democrat Party until he passed away and canvassed this county frequently for candidates. I claim lineage with Fred Vincent, who many in this area do. And, you know, as I said, we are a political family. But for myself, I've always worked in nonprofits and been more politically engaged in advocacy roles than having my name on the ballot. As a journalism major, I'm definitely engaged in staying informed and reading and watching news every day. I watched the budget process in Frankfort in January, the proposed budgets that were coming out of the legislature, and that's what prompted me to file for state representative. I'm a long-standing supporter, graduate of public school systems in our area. I graduated from Paul Blazer in 1985. And as a proud graduate of public schools, I really believe that the public school systems in our state have been under a concerted attack in recent years. And as I saw the proposed budgets that would really devastate our school system, specifically the departments of transportation within the public school system, it catapulted me into the race. I just was so adamantly opposed to what was being proposed. And I said that anyone who's come east of, no one proposing that budget could have ever come east of Moorhead and thought that it was a good idea. Mm-hmm.
No, certainly. You didn't need to go east of Moorhead. There were people in our part of the in our part of the state that were absolutely doing the same calculation. So, yeah, no excuse whatsoever.
I do know it was. It would definitely have been a statewide problem. So, like I said, in eastern Kentucky, the students truly, most families in this area, parents are working. Each parent is working. Some parents working two jobs, and they are reliant on those school buses to pick those children up mm-hmm. and get them to and from school. In addition to that, the after-school programs and athletics, the children here would not even be able to participate if it weren't for transportation, the school bus systems that take those children around. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, I just was so adamantly opposed to all of the budget cuts. And like I said, I'm preaching to the choir. I know you all know, since 2008, public education has suffered a gradual decline in funding. Mm-hmm. We need to restore the funding. I mean, that's sad when you say you need to restore funding to public education back to 2008 levels.
Right. Well, your primary was one of the most interesting ones in the entire state. You ended up winning the primary election by 16 votes, which was the closest margin in the entire state for anybody running for state legislative office. So I guess tell us how that happened. What do you credit to putting your campaign over the top?
Divine intervention. I prayed a lot. I would definitely say divine intervention and deep roots in Boyd County. Family and friends that really have known me a lifetime and supported what I want to do for Boyd County mm-hmm. stood up and really helped me get the word out. And it's the deep roots, the relationships that you build a lifetime. Those people went to the polls and they voted for me because they know why I want to do this and they support that. Mm-hmm. I have to say, though, I'm not surprised it was close because I've worked in nonprofits with my primary opponent mm-hmm. most of my career. We've worked in different organizations together, and I had the greatest amount of respect for her.
Sure.
And I know that she was a very clearly, being only 16 votes and news to me, the tightest race in the mm-hmm. state this year in the primary, that shows that, I was definitely running against a well-qualified opponent.
Right. Right. We connected a little before this and we uncovered that, you actually worked with my grandmother-in-law, but your primary opponent actually sold me my couch. So, I'm glad I didn't have a choice in the election.
She sold me a dining room table and a chair. That's what I said. I mean, it was really a difficult challenge when you're in a primary with someone that you've worked with, that you're mm-hmm. friends with, and that you have respect for. I wasn't running against anyone. I was running for Boyd County.
It's always good to hear when you have a lot of respect for your primary opponent, and I think that was the case in a lot of pretty contested races around the state this year. So there are 9 Democrats retiring from the House of Representatives, 8 of whom are men. 6 women are running to replace those retirees. So tell us a little bit how you will be a different representative than Representative Sennett and how you might be similar.
Well, I think we're definitely similar in that we both have the same goals and desires for the 100th district. I've been friends with Kevin, and only, you know, considered running for this seat when I knew it was going to be an open seat. I've been supportive of Kevin and am always happy with the work that he's done for the 100th District. I hope to stand in his position and continue the work that he has started for working families in the 100th District. Our support for the labor unions in this town, working families, and any legislation that protects public education, we're completely aligned on. And Kevin has been he's been very encouraging for my candidacy for his seat, and I consider him to be a very good friend. In how that I will be different, I do think the strongest asset that I bring to the table is the factor of time. I'm a small business owner, but that's for property rentals. Having that type of business allows me to have the time to focus on being a watchdog for Boyd County. I don't have split in. I know with Kevin, he was also very busy as an attorney and had his clients and working as an attorney with the city. So there were a lot of demands that sometimes that's really hard to juggle. I hope to be able to be very accessible to residents of Boyd County. That's one issue that I've promoted and said that I would really strive. I would have a constituent office open and would have public times posted that I will be here. And if I'm elected, people, you know, they will be able to come sit and talk with me in the district about issues that they feel are important affecting their lives. Mm-hmm. So I think that the time aspect that I would bring into this district for residents, it's something that's needed. It's hard to represent your constituents if you aren't able to meet with them on a consistent, regular basis and hear their concerns.
Sure. No, we've heard several candidates mention, you know, kind of like organizing their community in that way as being an important role for somebody who's a state representative. And it's good to hear that. I think that's absolutely true. And I think, you know, getting some different types of people into the legislature may achieve that goal. And I certainly think that looks like it would be the case with you. So this election cycle, you know, teachers have been front and center. Across the state, you know, those active in the teachers movement have really pointed to Eastern Kentucky and the teachers there as being some of the most active and passionate members in that movement. So tell us a little bit about how important teachers will be to your election coming up here next month.
Well, I don't just support teachers, I raise them. My oldest daughter is a teacher already, and my youngest daughter will be a teacher hired after 2019. My grandmother was a teacher. That's why I said teaching, it's not just a political position for me right now. This is personal. And teachers are extremely important in this election cycle because they are the backbone of the public school system. And I've said public education, in my opinion, is the cornerstone of this society. Every issue that we face, the solution to it is rooted in a well-educated individual. I really am passionate about protecting public education. And as I went to Frankfort almost every week in this past session and sat in sessions, sat in the committee meetings, stood out on the steps with teachers as they protested for their future. And that's what I said. My daughter is a teacher. She has three small children. She financially could not take the time off to go stand in Frankfort and fight for her future. But as her mother, I could. Mm-hmm. And so I was there every week on her behalf, and I hope to be in Frankfort in the future on the behalf of all the educators in this state. I think there is a concerted effort. I don't think the attack on teachers during this past session was just a standalone budgetary issue. I think there's a concerted effort to move towards privatization of education. Mm-hmm. And one of the best ways to do that is to break the backbone the teachers, the workforce. So if you can attack that workforce and diminish the quality of teachers that we have within our school systems and lessen the number of incoming qualified teachers, then our schools begin to suffer. Mm-hmm. The quality of education begins to diminish. So I really think that we have to all be on guard. This is not just a teacher issue right now.
I think it's really great that you pointed out that this kind of wasn't just a fluke, that like teachers were coincidentally harmed, because I definitely think you're right that it's part of an agenda of this administration.
Yes.
And
if you go back for 3 years with the first move being the reappointment of the board, then the second year we had the passing of legislation that opened up an avenue for charter schools. Mm-hmm. And then in year number three, we have a attack on the teachers' retirement system. So I'm really concerned about what does year number four hold.
Right.
And I hope to be standing in Frankfort so that I can push back against it. Because, like I said, teachers are in my bloodline. Mm-hmm. We all need to be really paying attention to the attack going on with public education. Mm-hmm. This is the one area where the playing field is still level.
Mm-hmm.
And all children have access to good quality free education.
Mm-hmm.
And that access to education allows a child from any demographic, any socioeconomic area to be able to achieve and succeed.
That's great to hear that you're passionate about that. I think that's definitely been a theme of candidates that we've interviewed. But switching gears a little bit, a major issue in your part of the state right now is Brady Industries, the aluminum mill that's scheduled to be built in the Ashland area. On the podcast, you know, we've detailed some of the scarier details about the deal between the state and the company, but we know that the promises being made by the company would provide the Ashland area with a lot of potential opportunity, especially since the idling of the AK steel plant. So tell us how you balance the hope that comes with the promises being made by this company with the facts that sometimes paint maybe a less rosy picture of the company than the stories being told by Brady and the state's leadership.
Well, that is the loaded question.
I know. Sorry.
No, I mean, anytime there is an opportunity to have innovative new business in your area that will provide, you know, if it's 50 jobs, but the opportunity to have 300 to 500 jobs and other businesses that will coexist along with that company and spur economic growth, that's something that we should all get behind. I think that is something we support. I understand the legislators from this area, why they encouraged it and why they want to support it. You want to give the opportunity to a company to come into your area. We certainly wouldn't have wanted to have closed the door on that. Having said that, I'm still pretty rooted in the industries that are tried and true and have been in this area for a century now. I come from generations of railroaders, and I had uncles in the steel mills. So my ancestors worked to build this community. I've lived here my entire life, and I don't have any intentions of going anywhere. So I'm a little protective of this area. I guess, you know, I'm kind of like a mother hen. So I would, you know, as a legislator, if you look at that as the aspect of a mother, you always encourage and want the best for your child, but you're also very protective of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm very hopeful that not only Brady, but many other businesses will see the potential for growth in this community. We have a skilled workforce that's second to none in this nation, and there are many businesses that see that. We take it for granted because it's inherently who we are. being a skilled laborer is passed down from generation to generation in Eastern Kentucky. And you truly just, it's like if you're a good cook and your mother and your grandmother taught you, you just take it for granted. You know how to cook. You don't realize that everybody doesn't know how to do that. And that's somewhat like our skilled labor in Eastern Kentucky. We take for granted just how skilled our workforce is and the work ethic that is bred here.
Now,
I do think this is a prime area for industrial businesses, innovative businesses like Brady to locate, and I encourage that. I would work with any groups that are wanting to bring jobs and economic growth to this area. But again, I was encouraged, you know, we've got K-Steel opening back up. It's not opening up as K-Steel. It's going to be still West Virginia. But we've got a steel mill opening back up. We're still a steel town in this area, and we still produce the best steel that comes out of this nation. With the recent federal changes to tariffs and different laws that are being, legislation that is being reworked, we've got one steel mill opening back up. We've got a growing, thriving refinery in this area that is expanding throughout this nation. And, you know, we've got another steel mill that, you know, we're all still very hopeful is going to come back up.
Right.
I'm looking at all these areas. Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely right. I really like what you had to say about the workforce there in Ashland. You know, you already mentioned unions and union membership as something that's important to you. And when you talk about skilled labor in Ashland, that also comes with a strong history of the labor movement. And you know, that's something that's probably taken more seriously out in that part of the state than anywhere else in the whole state. And you know, that's important to have jobs for those kinds of people, because those are important people. Speaking of jobs in the Ashland area, one of the major drivers in the Ashland area in terms of employment is healthcare. You know, Ashland is home to two major hospitals with very large networks of both physicians and affiliated practices. You know, the expansion of Medicaid that Kentucky has gone through hasn't just been good for patients in your area. It's also provided a lot of federal money from, you know, the federal government that's being paid to employees in your area. So tell us, you know, has the governor's Medicaid plan played a part at all in the campaign? And what do you kind of think about that?
In all honesty, there are so many varying issues in the 100th district right now that the Medicaid issue has not really been discussed as much as it should be. It's definitely a factor, especially in a budgetary concern, that has to be looked at. There's definitely two sides of the coin on this one, and you have to be able to pay for what you do. And I know there's been some varying proposals of taxing providers, but then, you know, you start to do that and those providers no longer want to see those Medicaid patients. So you can't do that either. I've really been reading and investigating what is going to be a good answer. And I don't think anyone, I mean, you all tell me, I don't think anyone in the state has found the right answer to this issue yet.
Well, I do think it's certainly not the governor's proposal, if you were to ask me. But I do think, I think that, you know, we've had our provider tax. It's been frozen since 2005. I think, you know, in most other states, the hospital association is offered pay directly for the Medicaid expansion if the state would let them. And I think, you know, going the wrong direction is of not providing the ability for people to pay or to have health care isn't the right way.
Yeah, I mean, here's the problem. A healthier society is a less costly society.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm never advocating that we don't provide health care or that we don't care for all individuals. Years ago I had a son who had a significant health scare, and thank goodness we were able to get him the treatment that he needed. And he's a healthy, thriving 20-year-old now, and I thank God daily. But that process, during that time period, it bothered me that if there were other children in the state that had the same health issues that we were going through but couldn't access the level of health care needed.
Mm-hmm.
Access to affordable and quality health care should not be something that becomes a political debate. I'm a proponent of prevention is the cure. I wish we could figure out a way to provide more services on the front end of early detection and prevention treatments, because what I said just a minute ago, a healthier society, you know, a healthier individual is less costly.
Right, right. I mean, I think we're mostly on the same page. Access is really important in figuring out a way that we can maintain that. And, you know, the fact is we get most of the money to pay for our Medicaid program through the federal government. So making sure that we protect those federal dollars coming in here is something that's really important. Well, speaking of the budget is, you know, the most important job of the mm-hmm. state legislature. And this year, of course, the budget process was basically totally broken. We had a budget passed at the last second with minimal debate, along with, you know, that sewer pension bill for teachers and, you know, a really bad tax reform bill. So we're interested. We've been asking everybody, how would you like to see the budget process improved? And then also in terms of substance, what would you like to see changed in the next cycle?
Well, the biggest issue that I've had with the budgetary process is the fact that we do not follow the process and protocol as we should. Our government was not designed to pass a budget in committee without full discussion, full representation, and full debate, and allowing the public to weigh in and weigh out. I mean, I realize when you're working on a budget, you can't lay that out and listen to the public, you know, protest it and debate it. We would never get anything accomplished. But you elect officials to go to Frankfort and represent your interests in that process. And that process in Frankfort's broken. People are hiding behind closed doors, working in secret, not working with others across the aisle to pass budgets that have a devastating effect on families and individuals in our state. And that is not how our government was designed to work.
Mm-hmm. No, that's certainly the case. Yeah, and we certainly hope that that gets improved with more Democrats in Frankfort next time around, including you. One of the other things we've been asking every candidate about is House Bill 29. We mentioned that the legislature passed a bad tax reform bill, but we think that this was a much better version. HB 29 is a tax reform bill that would help Kentucky with major revenue issues that we've been having. In the past, it's been sponsored by Jim Wayne of Louisville. And it's been co-sponsored by, you know, a litany of House Democrats. And the entire bill grew out of Governor Beshear's tax commission during the governorship. And so we've been asking everybody just really directly, do you support HB 29? And if so, would you be willing to co-sponsor it the next time it comes up?
To be honest, I mean, this is a bill that I would need to have more research on. You know, not being in the legislature and not having access to read all the intricacies of this bill. I like to really read and study. That's the journalist in me.
That's fair enough. You definitely want to know what's in it before you commit to supporting anything, but we definitely want to raise everybody's awareness of this bill.
I mean, the thing is, I oppose any additional taxes on working families. So that's where, you know, I have to see the legislation. I have to read it and really know before I commit that I'm not saying I support or oppose a certain tax legislation. Mm-hmm. Because, like I said, my key stance is fighting for the working families in Eastern Kentucky who have been hit really hard by different changes in the tax code. So I'm not familiar with, you know, House Bill 29 relatively to how it would affect those working families.
Sure.
Fair enough. So we've talked a lot about education and a little bit about healthcare. What are some other issues that you're passionate about?
It's a minor issue, but animal welfare legislation.
Okay, that's a good one.
Well, and like I said, I know in the course of all the issues that we are facing in Kentucky, and I'm passionate about, we've got to find a solution, a workable solution for the opioid crisis. Floyd County is now third in the state in overdose deaths. So that is a multifaceted problem with many variables. I firmly believe that we have got to sit down, work in a bipartisan way to form serious legislation to fight the addiction issues within our state. So that the issue of the opioid crisis is having an underlying effect on every aspect in our society. It's affecting the neighborhoods in our area. Mm-hmm. It's affecting people who are, you know, finding people who can work. I mean, people are having, you know, there are businesses that are having problems keeping their businesses staffed. We, you know, just discussing the Medicaid issue, it's taking a large toll on the bottom line and the budgets in many areas. So I said, I don't want to diminish what is really a huge issue in our area by saying animal welfare legislation, but I live with animals.
No, that's okay. We want to hear about all the things that you're passionate about.
And that's the thing. I was taken to school by an animal advocate this during the primary. And so I don't apologize for mentioning animal legislation at this point, because I'm also very, very passionate about child protection laws. Mm-hmm. And improving, you know, our social work areas to help with many of the issues we have with foster care and child protection and in our state. And as I was mentioning this to a lady who was very passionate in advocating for improved animal welfare legislation, I said, you know, I live with animals. I've adopted out of rescues, but I'm concerned that there are children in Boyd County who are living in, you know, less conditions than my animals are living in. So I feel like I need to focus on these children. And she looked at me and she said, why is it an either or?
Sure.
And I said, you know what? You're right. We can do both, and we can do better. And that, I guess, is my whole stance at this point. All of the issues that we're looking at, why is it an either or on any of them? And when we had the budget this year, just because there were issues with the teacher and the public workers' retirement under attack, working on the budget, why did that shut it down until the last minute? We're professionals. We should be able to do more than one thing at a time. Mm-hmm. And we should be able to listen to constituents protest and disagree with what we're doing while still being able to maintain doing the job that we're sent to do. Mm-hmm. So I look at all the issues that need to be addressed, but I also say, I can look at animal welfare legislation and I can do it too. Mm-hmm. It's not an either or.
Sure.
Right. Finally, how can people get involved in your campaign?
Well, I don't know that I want to shout my number out.
That's okay.
On radio, although I really don't mind to. I'm handing it out frequently to everyone, I have a headquarters.
And you've got a Facebook page too, right?
Well, I have a Facebook page, I have a website, I have an Instagram, I email, and like I said, I have a headquarters set up on Carter Avenue in the downtown area, so I welcome volunteers, I welcome people to come in and sit down and talk with me, talk about issues, let me hear your concerns, because as I just said, in the spring, I had a lady who corrected me. I felt like, you know, I needed to focus more on what I could do for children in the 100th district, and she straightened me out by me listening to her that I could do children and animals. I didn't have to choose. So I really welcome residents to come in and sit down and talk to me, because I think to be able to fully represent your district, you have to be willing and able and available to listen, mm-hmm. because you're a representative. Well, how can you represent if you don't listen to what people have to say?
All right. Well, yeah, that's great. And we really appreciate you coming to join us. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter at MyOldKYPod. They can like our Facebook page. Our podcast can be found on the podcasting app of your choice. We also have a newsletter that comes out on Fridays that you can subscribe to at tinyletter.com/myoldkentuckynewsletter. And last but not least, you can support us on Patreon. If you support us, maybe we could afford to send field reporters to these rallies that we're not attending. And you can do that for as little as a dollar a month, but as much as you'd like to at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.